Welcome to the Sound Girls podcast with Susan and Becky from Central Florida. It's been a rough week in the United States, Suze.
Mm-hmm.
How you doing?
It's rough. I think I'm obviously doing better than a lot of other people.
Yeah.
Safe in my house. And in Central Florida, we haven't had too bad of like protests, but we've had them. We've had stuff going on here. So it's been scary for the state of our nation, I think.
Agreed. So we want to give you some information and some resources with the Sound Girls in ways that we can be allies and help right now, too.
So we collectively prepared a statement because we felt like it couldn't go unsaid. So we wrote this down, and we're going to provide as much resources as possible, in addition to our podcast that we had previously recorded with Laura Dale. Her podcast, and you'll hear that coming up in a moment, is based on activism and the Onset Initiative and a bunch of other resources on another side of things. But we still wanted to make sure that we were addressing, because how could we not?
Exactly.
Sound Girls is deeply saddened and outraged over the murders of our Black citizens. Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd have been added to a long list. And while we mourn and protest, while rebellions and uprisings happen across the nation, and we've been here before, Watts 1965, Detroit 1967, LA 1992, and Ferguson 2014. How many Black lives have to be taken before something is done? We call for an end to the systemic and institutionalized racism that exists in all aspects of the United States.
Today, the music industry has organized a music industry blackout as a response to George Floyd's murder. It is easy for us to remove ourselves from a story, one that we are all implicated in. You have to choose what side you're going to be on. Sound Girls will not be participating in the blackout. Instead, we will be using the day to share information for protesters, anti-racist resources, reading materials, and organizations that are doing the hard work. We hope those working in the music industry will use their platforms every single day, not just one, to support Black artists. Please visit our website for a list of these resources, soundgirls.org.
Last night, I was talking to some other Sound Girls, and we felt that since we have a public voice and we have this podcast and we have a presence online, that we had to address it instead of just standing by, not necessarily pretending things aren't happening, but because we have that outlet, we felt obligated to say something and share whatever information that we could. So that is what we are going to try to do, not just today, or tomorrow, but forever.
Right. Forever. Please go check out the website. I looked at it just a minute ago, and I'm going to sit down with my notepad and my computer, and I'm going to go through every resource I can and see what I can do to be a part of the solution.
And share, you know, with our students, with our listeners.
Yeah, share.
Because we are privileged to have access to a platform like this. So we have to use our privilege for positivity as much as we can.
Agreed.
Welcome to Sound Girls Podcast. This podcast features an interview with Laura Dale, a Foley artist located in New Mexico. You can find Sound Girls on social media on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, soundgirls.org, and our website, soundgirls.org. Laura Dale is a Foley artist located in New Mexico. She has a varied and extensive career working in various sectors within film and television. And after reading her bio, I honestly think it would be best for Laura to tell us about herself directly. So welcome, Laura.
Welcome, Laura.
Thank you so much. I love supporting women in any kind of community, but particularly this one, because I feel like post-production and sound and there's a part of sound that is in everything. I mean, we now, everywhere we go, we turn on the radio, you know, we're podcasting back and forth, we're watching. Everything in our lives is dependent on sound in some level. And yeah. we've kind of lost a sense of the importance of the technical aspect of that. And so one of the things I want to speak to is just, I didn't know anything about film sound when I got thrown into this. I answered a Craigslist ad asking for an assistant to the woman who had done E.T.'s footsteps. And I didn't know what that meant. Fortunately, my husband is a sound engineer and he was like, that's Foley. I'm like, what's Foley? He said, that's, it's this incredible thing. It's just, you got to go to this audition and, you know, do it. And I'm like, I don't go to anything. I don't know what I'm doing. And he said, no, you're going to go. Even if you don't get it, it's such a unique, rare thing. You should do it. So I go to this little garage and there's this amazing woman there who's got this whole set filled with like all these different floor surfaces. She's got like 300 shoes sitting around. She's just got the screen up. And the audition was basically, I'm going to play this scene from a Bollywood movie where the character is being chased through cobblestones. He's jumping on rooftops. He's landing in puddles. He's being chased by dogs, whatever. And you're going to just get up near the mic and run and in whatever you think is sync to that guy's feet, because you're going to have to make the foot noises of whatever he's doing. And so I'm just terrified. My heart's pounding out of my chest. Cause like, you know, my background was dance training. I was trained in ballet and modern. And, you know, I worked with some great teachers. I went to New York to be a dancer and broke my foot. That kind of went out the window, but I still had that training. I had those chops. And so I'm just like, oh my God, oh my God. And this guy's like leaping and he's falling. And the first thing that happens, which probably drives, particularly sound engineers crazy, is when that guy takes off down the street, I want to run the direction he's running, which takes me completely away from the mic, which totally destroys my engineer's sound. So the terrible trick with Foley is the hardest one to master. And it took me about 3 years to really get it right, is to stay in place, even when the character is doing like a mile long marathon or leaping over, you know, in a running scene or something, just anything where someone's taking off and moving, you have to be able to go through your feet, heel toe, heel toe, heel toe. You can't just flat foot it, you know, which is the tendency when you're standing in place. Sure. We tend to at first do this real duck walk thing where we just plop, plop, plop. And the engineer's just like, I can't use this. I was like, okay. Because when you're walking, your foot's going forward, your heel's hitting first, and then your toe as you pass through. And if you haven't learned how to do that in place, ba-dum, 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 you don't make a good foot sound. So it took me about 2 or 3 years to master it. But on top of all that, you're doing things like kissing scenes.
So you do that on your hand.
You have to do the kissing scenes because the mic does not pick it up. And I was working on a project called Single Ladies, which was almost all female cast, predominantly African-American, which was really cool. Mm-hmm. But they were kissing all the time. It was like the office romance thing. And not just like two or three kisses, like 50 kisses and away from the camera, towards the camera, sideways. The guy's tongue, you know, it's like, what's going on? What's going on? And I'm just like,
so when you're doing that, are you moving your hand and your mouth like off axis of the microphone?
It's hard because
for
kisses,
like your head movement and stuff.
You gotta keep moisture because it doesn't sound good. And so your mouth will dry up because if there's a bunch of kisses, you're losing the, you know, and you don't have the counter from a real person. So it's just you kind of generating this, you know, and you feel like an idiot because you're just like, does it sound better on my arm? I'm like, you know, because the other thing with anything to do with Foley is your props or your footsteps will sometimes give out on you. And so like the best leading actress shoe you've ever worked with, suddenly that day it's not working. Or right. Another example is if you're doing like big fight scenes. So I worked on Expendables 1 and 3.
Yeah.
Sylvester Stallone and all of his buddies.
Uh-huh.
And an interesting mistake I made, I worked on Expendables 1 with Ellen Huber, who was the E.T. lady. So I got to sort of see how she did it. Expendables 3 was on my own. And this is like, what, 8 or 9 or 10 leading guys. And so the trick in Foley is you assemble your shoes over time. Because it's just like a guy, you know, recording his guitar and, you know, after 10 guitars, he finally finds someone that really works, or he has this guitar works better for blues and this guitar works better for, but it takes you a while to figure out your instrument, right? So I finally have about out of my 300, 400 pairs of shoes, I finally have about 30 to 50 that are really hard workers. And this one sounds like Meryl Streep. This one sounds like, you know, whatever. And so I get these great sounds. And then, you know, I've got 10 leading guides. They're not background people. So I have to have really distinct footsteps. So I'm running around because I've never had a project that big. And I'm running around to every thrift store there is, and they know me now. They'll be like, hey, I found this great egg beater. You know, it's like, oh, okay, great. Yeah. And I'm the one standing in the aisle with the shoe, like listening to it instead of trying it on, like I'm, you know, putting them. The old ladies will go past, like, I think there's a crazy woman in that. You know?
This lady's listening to her shoes.
Yeah, I was like, this cheap one.
That's amazing.
But the thrift stores love me because they're always like finding stuff for me and stuff. Like, what project are you working on now? Well, it's a horror. Oh, I have this cool spaghetti machine. But so I find all these army boots thinking. And the problem with Foley is you get literal. Okay. And we'll get to that in terms of horror. So you think, oh, he's got this big old black army boot. So I'm going to go look for a black army boot. So I went to all the Army, Navy and thrift stores and everything. Susan's like, yeah, I know this one. And so I come up with like, and I spent a fortune and I brought in all these hunkin' nasty, you know, German and whatever, all these army boots. And I've got them piled up and I'm so proud of myself because I did it on my break and all this kind of stuff. And I start walking Stallone and I've got the nastiest, like, you know, World War II army boot or whatever. And I start walking it on, you know, gritty cement, which is what the scene was. And it sounds like a woman's 9-inch high heel. Because
interesting.
A hard, nasty army sole on a hard surface sounds like a stiletto shoe. And my engineer's just like, oh my God.
It's all about like the illusion of it, right? It's not what it's actually sounding like. It's what you in your brain kind of imagine it sounds like.
What you said, Susan, your eyes, it is not literal. Foley is not literal. That's why you have to apprentice with somebody because, you know, and so to get back to horror genre, if someone's getting their skull smashed, I want you to tell the story you did about, you know, what this guy did for a horror situation.
Oh, yeah. So we were talking before we started recording, but when I was in college, I did an internship, and this was for my theater degree. So I have a theater degree and a minor in film. And this was for theater. And the sound designer had this really fun, like, head chop-off kind of sound, like someone's getting, like, chopped to bits. And so as an intern, I felt like, can you tell me anything about this? Like, can you tell me how you create these sound effects? And I honestly can't tell you if he was making it up just to freak me out or if it was true, but he told me that he took a pig into his bathroom and put it into the bathtub and just started like hacking away at it and then taking like ketchup bottles and like squirting it. And I was horrified. I'm like, okay, we're good. I'm good. I'm good. And then we're cool. And then after that, when I got back home and started actually trying to record my own sound effects and stuff, that's how I was learning so much about, it's not what you think it is. You don't need to literally cut into flesh. You can use like cabbages and celery and stuff like that. It's all about the idea of it,
So that was perfectly, that encapsulates what people get wrong when they first try to do their own effects, is they try to get literal. And so the mistake I made with those shoes was too literal. So I went tearing out almost in tears because we were behind schedule, and I went around and I found these powder blue Club Kid fake logging boots, right? And they're probably something someone wore to a rave in, you know, right, Colorado or something. And but with soft rubber soles, brought them in desperately. And you don't know, even if you try them in the store, you don't know what they're going to sound like under the mic. And for general, for my tech people who are listening, I just want you to understand, in terms of,
I was just
like,
gonna ask,
best case scenario, and every studio will tell you different, but across the board, what I've seen that people lean towards as far as what we will do in my studio is a Neumann KMR-81.
Okay.
That gives a really warm, human, organic tone. I cannot live without that mic. It's expensive, but it's worth every penny. Because it just gives you this human tone for your footsteps. And I will not do footsteps without it. The more precise and the metallic and the sort of technical kind of noises, like you're cutting foods and stuff like that with a knife and whatever, is going to be an AKG 416. And what my engineer has me do is just Velcro the two together. So I'll mount the one on the little holder and then put a couple of Velcro loops underneath and put the other one under it so that he can be recording evenly on both, but then pick and choose in the editing process. Cause sometimes the warmer tone doesn't work or works better with the cutting scene or whatever. So he has that ability to modulate back and forth, but it's a really good idea when you're recording Foley, to give yourself two different types of mics, if possible, the best you can afford. And you know, Neumann is, you'll hear Neumann a lot from a lot of the best studios that's what they're using.
Right.
The other thing is I can't talk too much technically because I'm just like, I tell people I'm the cave woman sitting, you know, banging sticks together and, you know, throwing dirt around. But, the preamp that I use, if you can find one, and again, it's an investment, but it's worth it, is the George Massenburg Labs. It's the GML 8300. It is so pristine. It doesn't take away or add anything to it. You're getting exactly what is happening from you. There's no translation. There's no messing with it. It's this beautiful, amazing machine. You'll find a lot of people, mine's kind of an older model, but it's fabulous. And if you could have just those three things or something close to those three things, you will be making some really masterful, you know, Foley recordings. But to get back to that, so I put on these boots, and even though they're just these like cutesy little club kid boots, they sound on that hard cement surface, kaboom, kaboom, kaboom. And Josh is just like, what is that? And I hold up the girly boots and he's like, I don't care. Just, you know, so those are my Sylvester Stallone. So if you ever watch Expendables 3 and he comes striding in, it's me in my little club kid boots, like, boom, 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 boom.
That's amazing.
That definitely like ruins the illusion of these like big action.
I'm totally gonna go watch the movie now just to see if I can find
when that's.
Oh, it's gory, Betty.
So so the trick with gore is you got to bust through. You've got thousands and thousands and thousands of cues a day, especially with something like Expendables. So you got to be able to just slam right through, right? And so when you have something like someone's head gets blown off or whatever, I'll go to Rosemary's Baby, which is what I worked on. There was a TV version of it. So there's a scene where Rosemary she's been infected by the devil. She's pregnant. She's starting to crave human flesh. She doesn't realize it, but the witch who's sort of grooming her, shall we say, has been feeding her these potions and stuff. And, you know, we've already seen her get raped, but not remember it and all this kind of stuff. And so she's in the kitchen, she's fully pregnant. And the witch has brought this big creepy thing that looks like a human heart. We don't know. And so the scene is the actress just like the baby inside her wants it, but she doesn't. And so, you know, and the sound is just the sound on the set, which is nothing, you know, it's just the kind of a bad bite noise or something. So we have to make this between my engineer and I, we have to make this into something that just is heart pounding. Right. And so in the previous scene, the witch had been making a potion with a pomegranate. So I'd gone and got a pomegranate because nothing sounds like it. You can't use an apple. You can't use a peach. You can't use anything. So that cut of the skin on that, you know, we'd done that whole thing and that had been sitting to the side. And so normally in like biting flesh kind of stuff, you're going to do wet chamois is your best friend in Foley. Just like your Neumann mic, you don't have a studio without it. Susan's like, yep.
Yeah, you
it's
just
for
like
everything.
You just
it's
slop
for blood
it around,
nurses,
right?
It's for puddles. It's for squeezing someone's eyeballs
chamois?
Out. Wet chamois, like that soft leather. It's got to be
leather. Like for your car,
not artificial. Yeah. You got to have that real chamois, right? Like that you polish your Porsche with or something, because it's really fine.
That's what I polish my Porsche with.
Your little Porsche,
totally
in your Benson.
But so
you always want to have a bowl of water that's really shallow filled because you don't want it too wet. If it's bloody gush, you want to take the chamois and squeeze it and let the blood drip down your arm and stuff and get that against the mic. But if it's just like an eyeball popping out or some creepy thing like that, you're just going to get it moist enough that it squishes, but not drips. And you just get it up against the mic, you know, these little creepy, meshy sounds. And that's the backbone of horror. And so chamois is the backbone of horror films. So you don't.
That thrills my soul.
Yeah, no. So you got to have chamois. And even if you're just doing like a rudimentary thing for some friend who just is, you know, scaring their mom or something, get your wet chamois and get it in there at all the six scenes. But in this particular scene, So I've got the pomegranate sitting there. And normally what we do is have the bite be like a ripe tangerine. So I'd gone out and okay. gotten that already. And I did the bite right when she cut through. So right when her teeth hit on the screen, you have to be really precise. And so there's those streamer things. Another essential for engineering is get those online, that free streamers program. And so mm-hmm. what the Foley Arts is trained to do is watch those 2 points. And I'm not even looking at the action. I'm looking at the point at which that little streamer meets the other one. I know that's when I take my first step or I bite through it or whatever. That's the first knife cut or anything. So streamers are really important if you're going to work with a Foley Arts, because that's what we're trained to look off of. We're not waiting for the action to happen. We're watching the streamers meet. And so I'm waiting for that moment. Josh has timed it perfectly for right when her teeth cut through. And so I do the tangerine and I do the chamois with the drip as the gut, you know, it's kind of coming down her face and stuff. And it's creepy, but it's like, and Josh is kind of like, you know, and we look over the pomegranate. It's like, okay, so grab it. And he just gets it timed perfectly. So right when you see her tooth come onto that thing. And when you mix that with the tangerine and the chamois, I had just done that and I'm going, oh my God, that is so creamy. You know, and that's the coolest thing about Foley is just the point where you just made all those sounds. You heard them and your engineer runs back and, you know, condenses it and mixes it perfectly. And it's just like, oh my God, that is perfect car crash. Or, you know, it's just, it's really fun, you know, cause all of a sudden it's 3D. And so with gore and stuff, things like snapping someone's neck. Susan had been talking about that as well. So why don't you speak to what you had, you know, you guys were doing cabbage and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, this was a long time ago because I haven't worked on a film in quite a while, but we needed just the creepy sounds. And I knew that it wasn't going to work for me to just get like chicken bones or something. Plus that weirded me out. Like no one's going to be cool with like literally hacking up animals, yeah, right?
That's not okay.
So it's gross. So I learned the celery trick, but I think with celery, you have to wrap something around it too, don't you? Do you put like a layer of something so when you crunch it, makes that good snappy sound? Or is it layered in post?
Usually that stuff is, if you want like a strangulation or something where neck bones are snapping, you're just going to, it's the torsion. So you want about 3 or 4 actual sticks of celery. Sometimes you can keep them attached the way you got them off the shelf and you just twist that, because you also want to get the first, like, you know, you want that yeah. first. And so there's these lead in moments. It's just like when a door opens, you don't just want, but you want, but you know, so you always want those up to the point and then the sound kind of actions. And so you're always looking for props and things you can manipulate that get you that initial start point and then the snap kind of thing. And so predominantly it's going to be like this snap is okay if like you're breaking a shin bone or something, because but you want a really hard piece of celery. Another thing is, so I had been helping Ellen with Conan the Barbarian, and they're just clubbing each other and, you know, smashing each other's skulls and all this stuff. And so I had to go out and find a bunch of small watermelons and cantaloupes. And I've got,
do those work best for like a head smash?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Because the watermelon has that hard shell, has the sort of breaking the skull sound. And then you've got the gush too on top of it. And so sometimes you'll do like 1 or 2 or 3 layers. So you'll have the actual smash and you want to get that impact point against the hard shell. So you can get some kind of crack noise, and you can even pull it apart and snap it too once you've opened it, and add that as a track, as like a, you know, the bone snapped apart kind of thing. But then you want to smash into the actual red and feel that gush and all that stuff hitting the ground and whatever. You also want to make sure that if that hit happened on a dirt surface, you're doing that in a dirt pit. If it happened on concrete, you're doing it on concrete, because wherever that falls, the impact point of all that detritus, you're going to lose the reality if it was dirt and you're hearing a concrete fall.
That's so cool. So you have to think through like every little aspect of it and every little sound, exactly. Like the what leads into the sound is, and what comes out of it.
And then on top
just
of
that one little.
So what makes a Foley rather than a Foley technician, we're called Foley artists. I don't just have to master those footsteps for male, female, child, dog, whatever. I have to master the emotional content of it. So the lady's walking down the hallway after just being told her husband died of cancer. You know, she's in the hospital. So I'm not just doing, you know, her, the right shoe, you know, the low heel, kind of soft. I'm doing the sadness of it. I'm doing the fact that she kind of stumbles at a certain point. Or the guy's furious. The boss just fired him. He's wearing these big logging boots. He's out stomping in the parking lot, whatever. I have to, I can't just walk the steps. I have to convey, if I'm doing justice to it and if I'm working with big name stars, I'm adding to or taking away from their performance by the degree or lack of emotion that I'm involving in those footsteps. And so that's
so you basically got to immerse yourself. Yeah, you. So you exactly. You've got to become the artist, the actor, the actress, the animal, the whatever. So you've got to play 1,000 roles just in making your sound
exactly
and what, be what it
yeah,
is.
And when people say, you know, I want to be a Foley artist, it really helps to have a dance background. You don't have to. A lot of people from music or you know that kind of thing, or just even kind of. Martial arts or something where you really have to work top and bottom, foot and hands kind of, you know, detail. Although Jack Foley himself was not trained in anything. He showed up right as the studios were transitioning from silent to sound. And he's one of those people where you needed a set built. Jack's already rolling up his sleeves, grabbing the hammer and building. So he's on Universal and he's just this all purpose dude. Nobody knew Northern California like him. So some of the earliest, pre-sound and sound westerns and stuff that were being filmed up in Northern California, Jack was oftentimes the location scout for that because he was a big nature boy and he would, oh, there's this great, you know, whatever, redwoods and such. So he was an all-purpose dude who nobody understands why he had the gift. It doesn't make it, he was a naif character. He just, it didn't, no background in music or anything like that. And so Universal gets Showboat. And at the time, none of the studios really wanted to get on board with sound. They thought it was clunky and annoying. And honestly, 80-foot sets with those early mics, it was a nightmare. You know, I mean, it was just a nightmare. Yeah. And they really didn't want to have to keep going with it. And so some studios were on top of it. Others weren't. And then Jazz Singer came out. And even though it's a deeply racist and kind of creepy film now, it was huge. It was like Star Wars box office. And so everybody's running around, okay, we got to do this. Where's the musical? Blah, 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 blah. So Universal gets Showboat. And just imagine whatever it was, 30, 50, 80 extras all stomping around doing these dance numbers on this big fake boat in a gigantic sound studio. And you're talking a train wreck of noise. But with that many people dancing around, when you pull the sound out completely and just do music with that many people dancing, it's not working. So they realize right off the bat, they're going to have to do footsteps, particularly for the dance numbers. And so for some reason, Jack could just stand there. He's like a big guy. He's like over 6 feet, very solid person, kind of lumberjacky a little bit. But for some reason, I think he even did like Greta Garbo's feet. He just had this amazing knack for becoming a person that he was looking at, feeling into all the steps they were taking and just matching them. And he didn't come from radio. He didn't come from any of it. And that's kind of one of the reasons we call it Foley is because he was just such an extraordinary character. You know, he wasn't the pioneer. The pioneers were the radio people, obviously. And I think you were talking to this, Susan, or were you about just, you know, this started before Jack, you know, this history of sound and how you convey things was it's a artifact of radio, but Jack made
it. Yeah.
Sound is always something in films that people have overlooked, and I feel like they still overlook it now, even though it's obviously been part of our history in filmmaking for almost 100 years. But it was absolutely in radio, because before we had moving pictures, they had radio shows. And so in the studio, as they were doing these like live broadcasts, they would have all of these like items, the thunder machines, you know, like the they were like thin pieces of metal that they would shape. Yeah. They had all of that stuff going. And so for them to be so resistant to it at first is bizarre, because it's 50% of a movie is sound. It's picture
exactly.
and sound
and
together
nowadays,
completely.
And we were talking about this, nowadays with all the VFX and CGI, It's mm-hmm. way more than that. So when I first started doing Foley, I was given a specific statistic that I wasn't sure it was 100%, but they were basically saying a normal studio shoot, a feature shoot, they're going to wipe about 60% of the soundtrack. So you're only hearing about maybe 40% of the original sound. With all the VFX and CGI stuff, you know, something like Toy Story, they're wiping 100% of everything. When you're watching a major action
really?
Film, they are building the entire sound from top to bottom.
I've wondered about
every,
that.
Every, like, movement everything. Somebody makes. Like, you get out of your car, think about all the sounds you're making with it, taking the keys out of the ignition, opening the door, moving your clothing across the street as you're getting up, putting your foot on the ground. Like, if they have to replicate every single piece of that, that's a huge feat it's to massive. Do.
So if you're doing, like a feature film, like The Expendables, or let's go with CGI. So you, what have you done CGI-wise, or... You know, like you said,
I
Toy
haven't
Story
done
or whatever,
a ton of animation stuff, but Ellen did. She'd worked on Cars. She'd worked on. She told a cool story about Cars. There's always this intention. It was the same thing I had when I did Expendables. There has to be a distinct sonic footprint, literally and figuratively, for every character. So Stallone's boots can't sound like Mickey Rourke's,
right?
Because you're not doing honor to their stardom. If all your leading men sound exactly the same, it starts to get monotonous and boring, and they don't have screen power anymore. So one of your jobs is to have enough shoes that are distinct, that if you have a bunch of leading men and a bunch of leading women, there's a sonic footprint. So if, you know, Betty Davis comes from off screen on screen, I know it's Betty because I've gotten used to in the movie, this is her coming. That's what that shoe sounds like, right? And so you're creating these footprints. And one of the things you have to do, even with props and stuff, is you have to create these sonic qualities that are remarkable, that are like thumbprints. And so, you know, part of it's how you walk, and part of it's, you know, all there's a lot of nuances. But I'm trying to think in terms of some of the films I've done. I know Ellen was talking about with Cars, there was a thing where they all have steering wheels, they all have doors, they all have headlights, they all have these things that happen equally amongst all of them. How do I make the Chevy or whatever sound different than the Corvette or the blah, blah, you know, I can't remember the titles of all the cars at this point, but,
right.
But each one had to have its own sonic footprint. So, you know, different steering wheel sounds for when this one turns. And, you know, some of that was sound effects and some of that was Foley. But
so that was going to be my next question. Like, is how much Foley versus a sound effect? And then also, how long does it take you to do like a whole feature film?
So
years or months or.
So the thing about Foley, I think one of the reasons Foley artists aren't recognized as much as they should be is that we bust through things really, really fast, compared to anybody else. So Ellen was working on, you know, Cars, and one of the things that they had been dealing with is they sort of exhausted all their nuances and possibilities, and they'd gotten to that kind of stoner VW bus. I don't know if you remember that from the show, but the bus, they were trying to create this quality. They sort of exhausted everything. You know, they'd used up all their props and their ideas, and you know, and this is a story I was told. They didn't know. So they got to the bus, and it was like he comes on, and he's always kind of doing these zigzaggy turns and then sort of jiggling a little bit, and he doesn't come to a complete sudden stop. And there was these qualities about that character, and they didn't know what to do. And they finally, the story I heard is that they went out to a junkyard in LA and found this really old gas tank from a bus or something. And they had two Foley artists, and they filled it quarter with water and quarter with cooking oil. So it had this really sloshy, sloggy sound. And so when the bus would come onto the screen, that the two of them would sort of match the movement. But then they realized if they kept moving, there wouldn't be a sound because it would all just sort of blend into itself. But if they found specific stop points and then let the oil just go slug, 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 slug. So they would watch it and find, okay, right when he turns there, we're going to stop. Slug, 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 slug. And so then that gets layered on top of the tire squeal, which is a sound effect. you know, the door might rattle, the seats might make a weird noise, that, you know, there's all these layers that you're doing in it. And so the trick with understanding Foley versus sound effects, if you've gotten, let's say both of you finished a feature film, you're handing it off to the studio. Post means post. So especially people who are on a tight budget, you don't do anything in post-production until you're sleeping at night. This is the edit you want to see on the screen. People don't understand. When you decide later, oh, I want to take that scene out and whatever, we don't get to start from scratch again. We've moved on to our next project. We don't have all that stuff in archive.
It has to be picture locked. And that was the most infuriating thing when I worked on micro budget films, especially right after college, is they would give us things that weren't finished.
So explain that further, Susan. Explain that from your background.
Because
this is a pet peeve of mine with filmmakers. This idea that I can come in later, like a writer does, and just change my edit. No, this is the book that's already been published in hardcover. And now you're going to tell me to come in and change that chapter. We have to reprint the book.
Yeah.
Explain that.
Right. So in filmmaking, I mean, I've done micro budget films. So that means like anything with, I think the number is under $200,000 or something, but ours were small. And that was the hardest thing for us to get these independent filmmakers to understand, is it has to be picture locked. So that means your edit has to be complete. This is the finished like cycle of everything. So you're not going to add a scene. There's nothing else to go back and film. You're not going to change a single thing about it. It has to be absolutely finished before we as sound designers or sound editors can go in and fix it. So sound editors and regular editors usually can work kind of alongside each other while they're still like editing from a feature standpoint. But anything after that, any mastering, any sound effects that we need, that's afterwards. Because if I'm recording custom sound effects or you're doing custom Foley work, that's literally weeks of work that we could just cut out of a movie because it wasn't finished. Or they're like, oh, I'm going to change it from this scene to now it's a totally different location. We reshot it. So now I have to pay you again to go redo all that stuff. And they don't want to do that, especially for independent movies, because they don't have the budget.
That's what I try to do.
So now you're working for free?
And that's
absolutely
what I try to tell, you know, because we've got a lot of great indie filmmakers out of it. I try and tell them, you don't even go near me. You don't even, because they'll approach me before they've even started. Like, oh, I really want you to do Foley in my film. I want to do Foley in your film. It's going to take you a year and a half to get this done. Come back to me in a year and a half. I will do it.
Yeah.
But talk to me when you're done, and it's done. You're not going to change the edit. And what people don't understand with sound, as only sound engineers do, I'm not handing you the 900 tracks that we generated. I'm handing you the mixed down, whatever it is, 10 tracks or whatever. So I'm not handing you all those little pieces. I'm handing you blends and blends and blends. It's like the difference between all your ingredients sitting on the kitchen table for the bread you're going to make, right? Or the cake. Versus the mixed cake. And now you want me to take parts of that cake out and make flour again. I can't do
That's a great analogy. You can't you can't make flour from
that
cake.
To people. I have to get kind of simplistic. Yeah. You're telling me take all the ingredients out of that final mix of cake and put it back on the counter and start again with more salt or something. That's not how it works, right? And so that's it's a pet peeve of mine, of just, not that anybody's wrong, because I was that ignorant before I got into this industry. But if independent people understood the process more, particularly the post-production process, and my new engineer right now is saying, we need to start doing talks that work backwards, that work from the finished product and go backwards. Because I do a lot of talks around the state about Foley and the importance of sound and all these kinds of things. But we need to start with, here's the final product. Here's the segment. This one, it's the soundtrack. This one here, so that the things we dealt with in terms of, you know, the squeak or the rattle or the whatever, we can now go backwards and find the point where you picked the noisiest place to shoot in the entire city. And now you're complaining that we had to redo the entire sound setup, you know? And so I'm trying to become a sort of educator. I come from East Village Underground. I'm from New Mexico, but I lived in New York in the Keith Haring days, in the, you know, Basquiat days. I would leave my little rent-controlled apartment in the East Village and walk past Tompkins Square Park, and there'd be brand new Basquiat graffiti every single day and Keith Haring posters in the subways and stuff. And so I was part of this sort of nitty-gritty, roll-up-your-sleeves DIY culture that was very vibrant. You know, every kid on the street corner had his brand new rap tape, you know, and it wasn't rap, it was hip-hop or whatever. But it was an amazing time, and I just, my heart is with smaller independent things. I got to see the first screening of Spike Lee's She's Gotta Have It. I got to see the first screening of Desperately Seeking Susan in a little art house. I got to see all these things that just shouldn't have happened. Spike Lee should have never happened. African-Americans were not getting any kind of film distribution whatsoever. And to be in New York in August, which is death knell for film, nobody puts out a film in August, particularly back then.
Yeah.
And have the underground buzz that was like, oh my God, this all black cast, it was black and white, it was under 30,000. Everybody in the East Village was just like, how did this happen? You know, and he broke a lot of doors for people, but he also broke it for everybody. Because at that time, independent meant poor as a church rat. You know, I mean, just no money, no recognition, no anything. You only did it for love. And here's this guy suddenly getting mainstream recognition with a skin color that does not get recognized at that time.
Right. That was astonishing. Actually, before his film, I don't think I even really knew much about independent films. I knew people watched them, but I don't think I had ever watched one before that.
Yeah.
You know, and it created so much buzz that now, like, I love documentaries. I love small films, short films. You know, there's that realness, that genuineness there with it that I love so much, you know. And information too. It gets out a lot of information. So I love it.
Well, I want to shout out to Spike Lee because he's difficult in the sense that he doesn't want to be oppressed anymore. And the studio system is oppressive and is particularly oppressive to people of color. And so the media tends to portray him as this difficult person. He's not. He's just standing his ground, and his level of integrity and the amount of breakthrough that he created within the independent film community, I think just should be remembered forever. That was amazing what he did. And it was impossible. So many things came through after that. And I think, you know, I worked on something called Drunktown's Finest, and we have a lot of indigenous community here, First Nations peoples. And this was a Navajo project. I think Zuni Navajo. Anyway, Sydney Freeland is transgender Navajo. And she'd apprenticed, or she'd been at Sundance, I think, for several years, and she'd been working on these projects, and she was trying to break into the industry, which is A, hard as a woman, but B, hard as a First Nations woman. And Redford saw something in her, and so they mentored her, and they gave her scholarships and things like that. And so over a period of time, she was taking screenwriting classes, this and that, but she kept trying to do mainstream. You know, she kept trying to do the standard thing that gets sold in a studio. And thank God, I think it was actually Redford, sat down with her at one period in the thing when she'd handed in a script and was like, why don't you write about your experience, transgender, Navajo, you know, all this. That's what I want to hear. That's why I'm doing all this, you know. And she was just shocked because no one had wanted to hear her story at that point. So she made this.
What's the name of her film?
Drunktown's Finest. And it's just a commentary. That's what her town, you know, in Gallup, New Mexico is called, Drunktown.
That's a great name.
Well, because, you know, there's just the poverty level is, I think it's the highest poverty level in New Mexico. I could be wrong, but it's tough. It's a really tough place, and the kids really struggle there. And then to be transgender on top of it. Although another thing she pointed out is certain indigenous cultures will actually revere transgender. They feel that they're sort of between worlds and might have access to greater sort of knowledge and wisdom. Mm-hmm. And so certain cultures, I think I heard that the Hopi, but I don't want to misquote, but I think I heard the Hopi, if a child showed sort of dual characteristics, they were immediately taken on by the spiritual elder as being special and having that sort of calling. So that's another interesting thing about indigenous wisdom. Like,
that's great.
What if we look to that as well? You know,
what if we look to that?
But it was really cool. That speaks to how many layers of sound can be in something and why this has to be final. There was a scene where it's three storylines, and one of them is the male character. He's trying to leave the reservation, frustrated, decides to join military, but he starts drinking and gets arrested and loses his ability to leave. And so his thread is just being stuck on the res, chain smoking, frustrated. And there's a certain point where I think it's his uncle character comes in, drags him out into a big field and makes him chop wood. And the guy's like, he picks up the axe and he can't do it and it's falling everywhere and whatever. And so I, with my background, I knew that this had to be a powerful scene. This is the point where he changes from frustrated, you know, James Dean character to I'm fully native, is he finally learns how to chop wood. And so my engineer and I, that's the blessing about working on smaller budget films, is that normally with Expendables, you're just trying to slam thousands of cues back to the studio, right? But in this particular instance, we had some time. And so we set aside and we made, I think we made 7 or 8 tracks. First one is just the hands against the axe handle. Second one is the head of the axe hitting the wood, like the actual impact point. Another one is when the wood would fall against itself. So there, I'd be sitting in the dirt pit and I have 2 logs that had good resonance and I'd be sort of knocking them against each other in sync to when the things hit. Another one was when the wood would actually tip over and hit the dirt. So I'm in the dirt pit and I'm just dropping logs in sync with as it hits. The biggest thing though was that that point when he finally severs through the log was really critical. It would have taken me an hour, especially as bad as I am at hacking wood, to even get the right sound for it. So balsa wood. Balsa wood is your chamois for wood stuff. Susan's like, yeah, I know this one.
I'm no, like, I don't even know what that is.
Balsa is just, you know, when your little brother or your, you know, cousin or whatever was always making his little toy airplanes.
That's the little stuff. It's just like that flexible kind of
really
like
thin wood. Yeah.
Nice. Man, I'm learning so many things today.
Splinters like nobody's business, man. When you need to hack some wood or, the, you know, that scene where Jack Nicholson hacks through poor, is it Shelley Duvall in The Shining?
Yeah.
There's a lot of balsa wood that died for that. You should go back and listen to that
one. I'm going to go back and listen to that for sure.
The Shining sounds, man. There's a lot of stuff happening in just that one moment because it had to be just like soul wrenching, you know?
The Shining is one of those soul wrenching movies for me, for sure.
So that thing, you know, if you listen to Drunktown's Finest and you do the campfire scene, it just sounds like a real campfire scene. The other thing is anything lighting, like with a cigarette or I'm lighting the campfire or something, the crackle is what sells it. So there's a thing in Foley called a sweetener. That thing I told you about the biting through.
The pomegranate.
That was a sweetener. It's the icing on the cake that makes it where you get chills or where you start crying or whatever. It's the thing where it just suddenly sounds so real that there's no way that was made in a studio, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's always just these moments. And so with any kind of fire scene or when someone's lighting a cigarette, the two biggest things is how you pull it out of the packaging, whatever packaging it's in, and how you handle the lighter. And then once you get it up there and you take the breath, you're just taking the, so you get the inhale sound and you get the exhale. So that's a track, right? But then you've got your cigarette tip and right where the tobacco is, you're just making a little crackling sound. So whenever, like with Rosemary's Baby, there's a point where the bad guy is smoking before he does some horrific kill. And so he takes this deep inhalation. And right when you see the red show up, if you get a little fingernail crackle of that tobacco, it's every cigarette noise you've ever heard in your life.
This is funny that you brought that up because I used to watch The X-Files religiously and the smoking man on The X-Files.
Yes.
They did such a good job.
If you don't have the crackle.
Him, the smoking man, like you can hear the smoke almost when you see the scene, when you walk in the room and that crackle is always there. And now that you're saying stuff like this, like I'm remembering it like, man, that is so
And you
cool.
as an audience, even though you don't know that's what's going on. So the other job in Foley is to know all these tricks, these layered tricks, because if I don't do them, my audience has been trained over an 80-year period with great Foley artists to expect certain things. They won't know why, but they'll just be like, oh, did the sound drop out on that? You know, because they're expecting the crackle. And if you're not, that's why you need an apprentice with Foley. You need somebody who can teach you all those finalizing sweetener tricks that turn it from sounds to that was real.
So Laura, speaking of that, like if there are other sound women out here listening and they're super interested in the Foley world, how do you get into that? How do people find apprentices?
I don't normally I don't recommend Craigslist ads, but that obviously has success for you.
Right? Like, yeah, that's actually how I met my husband. So I don't know what to say. I think Craigslist.
Hey, man. I was like, Craigslist in your area seems to be popping.
Or just say, I don't know. Maybe in a past life, I set up a little portal where Craigslist was going to be where all the... it's tough because there's not that many of us. We bust through things really quickly. You were asking about the process. Normally what happens in a big studio project, at least in my experience, and everything's going to be different. Each one, even the equipment I told you about, isn't necessarily what everybody uses. We're all just trying to get the best sounds, right? The first thing is someone at the studio will get the final edit, the picture lock, as Susan rightly pointed out. And they may still be doing colorization or whatever, but this is the final edit. This is the final sequence of timing and events. And so we're getting 15-minute segments. Someone at the studio has been breaking down every single cue. And those are the real slaves and gods of this, because having to sit through and get every single Sylvester Stallone footstep, every type of shoe, every surface he's on, and demarcate that, and then have the start and end point for every single time he moves and stops, moves and stops, moves and stops. Now he's on tile. Now he's in boots. Now he's in dress shoes. Now he's in wood. Now he's coming upstairs. All of that has to be marcated on these little cue sheets. So the real hard work, in my opinion, I mean, I will be bruised sometimes after sessions, but the real hard work is the meticulous minds that can come in. If you want to get into Foley and really learn it, just offer to do cues for somebody, because they'll probably be so grateful.
That sounds like such a nightmare.
And some people are just extraordinarily good at it. Some people are just, they love watching, like you moving around right now. There would be a chair noise cue. There'd be you jump, you know, doing that movement in your chair. There'd be your 2 feet going up on the seat. There'd be your hand grabbing your pants. There'd be the movement you did on the table. So there was about 15 soundtracks just to you moving in your chair like that.
Wow.
And a good Foley cue person will live for that. They'll be like, oh, I should have a little bit of an eyeglass noise too. Or her cord went against her chest. So let's put that in there. You know? So it can be fun for the right person. And if you find a good cueer, you're well on your way to mastering excellent film sound, because they're already going to have the eye for you. They're already going to find everything. The Foley artist is just following those tracks. Now, when we do independent, we do the cues ourselves. And that's where I start being very, oh, I love these cue people, because I can't do this anymore. I can't write Stallone, brick, suede shoe, Stallone, outside. But basically what you're doing is you're sitting, in our case, you're sitting on Pro Tools with picture. And you're just, okay, Stallone enters sometimes it can take you a while to find out, is he on brick or not? I can't tell. I'll have to fast forward and watch through the scene. Oh, that part was brick. Sometimes the studios will already give you a list of what your surfaces are. Sometimes you'll never see them. Sometimes everything in that scene was shot from the waist up. So you're just like, okay, it's a dining room. I'm going to make it like a nice hardwood, you know, and hope that that's okay. It could have been linoleum. I don't know. So when you can't see the floor surfaces, you're making the best educated guess. When you can, you may have to hunt for it. So you do the work you have to do initially with cueing is the Sherlock Holmesian. What is the surfaces? What kind of shoe? You oftentimes don't see their shoe. Sometimes you have enough of a track that you can hear. And that's the other question I get. And this is for any sound person out there who does boom mic, because they can get depressed after my talk. Cause when I tell them 100% is wiped.
Yeah.
What I make sure and tell them is, you guys have no idea what a lifeboat you are as a good boom mic person for us to recreate. Cause what we're trying to do is not make our best noise. We're trying to make our most authentic to whatever was recorded on set. I'm not, even if that wasn't the greatest recording because there was airplanes or whatever, there's an authenticity to that original sound when Tom Cruise had those Converse sneakers. And I get to hear what that original noise was because an excellent person gave that to me. So I always tell people, we actually need you more than ever, because you are our roadmap to total authenticity in this. Otherwise, we're making stuff up that may or may not feel right for what was actually on set. So boom mics, I think, are, it may seem like an obscure thing and you may never hear your sounds on the screen unless you're doing like a documentary and it's really authentic, or, you know, we did use some of the actual stuff, but you are the roadmap to the best post-production sound, because you're giving us the doorway into that wonderland that that set was. And so
that's so great. Yeah. Like how everything works together. Like even you might not be the person with the end result, but we all play a part, you know, in making a film or making an album or whatever we're doing. So,
and speaking to your point, in order to fully understand the animal that is film, it's this giant thing that's bigger than all of us. When I walk in mm-hmm. with a script and it becomes Star Wars, it's gone through entire universes of mutations.
Yeah.
That's why your screenwriters get so frustrated. That's not what I wrote. Stephen King's always like, that's not what that, blah, blah, blah. You know, the biggest one is Shining. Stephen King was furious about what Kubrick did with Shining. It wasn't his book at all. It's a masterpiece. It's a gory, disgusting masterpiece, but it's a masterpiece. And honestly, that film I struggle with as a woman, because there are some people who have alluded to the fact that he kind of broke Shelley Duvall a little bit in getting those performances. That was kind of onset torture. And that's something I struggle with as a woman. I struggle with it a lot, actually, in Foley in general, because there are some scenes that are sex scenes that, because of what I went through, I'm not entirely sure were consensual. And so there is an ethical part of filmmaking to me that's a little difficult. It's kind of what Susan was talking about with, like, oh, if it involves an animal. I will tell you, you know, there was a scene in Rosemary's Baby where the witches, the early witches, so there's ancient witches that are the haunting of the new witches. And so the ancient witches, they go back to some like French brothel or something, and the witches are in the back and they're carving up somebody, right? The way you do that was a chicken. And nothing works like just baked chicken gotten from the, you know, the deli. So I went running out, got two or three chickens, because I was going to hack the heck out of them, because this is a gruesome scene. They're just carving this body up. And I had chicken flying everywhere. I had just like, I was cleaning up little pieces of grease from, you know, and I clean my studio really a lot, because you can't have extra debris from a previous session. It has to be a clean slate every single time. Yeah. And I was still finding, like, underneath a desk, a little piece of chicken, or off in the filing section or something, like a little bit of grease.
Why does your desk smell like chicken?
But it's there's a thing, and that's what I want to speak to. I'm working on something called the Safe Sets Initiative, because I was a survivor of severe sexual harassment on a remote location in my 20s. I was going to be an actress. I was all slotted. I'd taken all the classes. I'd done everything you're supposed to do. I'm going to get my SAG card. And they closed me on a remote location set in a mesa in northern New Mexico. And they're talking about this sex scene that's coming up that's not in my script. And nowhere did I agree to that. And it got so bad that I finally was like, I got to leave the set. I got to negotiate this someplace safe where I'm, you know, this is Puyi Cliffs. It's in the middle of nowhere, 200 feet off the ground, dirt mesa. And go towards the exit, and they barricade it. And they send a big, you know, moving like a film truck in front, and we're trying to find another way off. I was there with my then boyfriend, and they're chasing after us, and there's no other exit. And so we just had to make this decision to just accelerate towards this guy and hope that he would move. And he moved, fortunately, to the right, so that we could slope in towards the angle of the trail, the tiny trail, because if he'd moved to the left and we'd had to go the other direction, we probably would have fallen off 200 feet, and I might not be telling you this story. So there is a part of the industry that we all know, the Me Too is bringing it up, that can be very ugly.
Yeah.
And most of that, in the only word I can apply towards it is consent. It doesn't matter what you do on film. What matters is that you had autonomous consent for every aspect of that. So if you want to do hardcore porn, and there is total consent and total agreement and total adult, every part of this is agreed upon, I don't care. You know, as long as it's not harming children or animals, I don't care. My problem is there are many, many times, and it's hard for me with my experience because I get triggered. There are many, many times where I'm watching stuff and I really don't know if that actress or actor agreed to that scene. I don't know if they were pressured into it later. Or whatever. So I'm trying to create this delicate balance of awareness that film is it's exquisite. It's extraordinary. It's one of the greatest human inventions other than like music and, you know, just art in general, but it's also very dangerous. And one of the reasons I love doing this podcast is I feel like if we get more women in there, women who are doing the job because they're good at it and not because the director had them sleep with them or right. the head of the studio or whatever the old paradigm was, uh-huh. we changed the culture. We changed the whole thing from the ground up. If everybody yep. in film is A, good at what they do, not good at sleeping with somebody, and B, mm-hmm. that everything they do is consensual, so that I know as a viewer, when I'm watching something, yeah. I can rest. No one was harmed in the making of this movie. You know,
that should be the title on every movie, right? No one was harmed.
No one and nothing was harmed in the making of this movie.
Yeah.
So that's my goal right now. I'm working on something called the Safe Sets Initiative. And the idea is in New Mexico, we have, because of my experience with Puya Cliffs, we have a unique situation because it's an incredible landscape. And we have, I was telling you the population here only recently is about a crowded suburb in Los Angeles. So this entire gigantic state has a tiny population. Yet we're known as the Breaking Bad territory. We're known as all these things. We have this big, you know, we have good people here, really good tech people. And so it's becoming a sort of second desert Hollywood. But the problem we have is that sometimes 2/3 of our productions are remote location with potentially no cell phone access. So I've been in dialogue with the state about, with real cooperation from them. I have to say, in 31 years of banging my head about this issue, I have never seen the interest and the energy and the commitment to safety on sets, particularly remote sets, as we have. And the agreement that we had at our meeting, which was last November, I think, was if we do this right, because it's a tiny state, we can do it faster than some of the bigger states. We don't have to work through as much mm-hmm. bureaucracy. But if we do it right, we can help other states that have these issues with remote locations. And so, for example, let's say what happened to me is happening again. Pray it doesn't, but unfortunately I heard from an actress recently a similar scenario. So these things can happen. A lot of times they're smaller, sort of smaller budget rogue. The bigger companies, because of the insurance liabilities, are usually really good about this. I have to say, like Sony and stuff like that, they're spectacular in terms of harassment response and stuff. So, you know, bless you. But, you know, people can go rogue. And so the idea is, all right, we need satellite phones. I'm on the Mesa again. And they're coming after me. I need to call somebody. Well, mm-hmm. my cell phone isn't working. Okay. Right. Well, we know the satellite phone is the reporting phone. If I suddenly head towards the trailer with the satellite phone, they're going to know I'm going to report them. Right. So am I going to report them? Probably not. So what do we do to make that more seamless? And so the idea was maybe what we do, and it was a really good idea. I forget who it came from. I think it's Employment Development Department or Economic Development. But the idea was let's do extra education for on-set medics because they're already carrying a satellite phone. And so what we do is have, you know, you just pretend and your elbow got bumped or you pretend you cut your finger, you go to them, you mm-hmm. have a code word. They know that code word means harassment. And then right. the other thing that I thought was really cool, and we're still working to, you know, we don't know if it's going to have to go legislatively or if we can do it other ways. But the other thing would be we have a strong incentives program. So if I'm going to do your porta potty contract or I'm going to do your food truck or whatever, I don't get it. I don't even get to apply for it unless I have the reporting stickers in every single dressing room stall, in every bathroom stall, on the side of the food truck, whatever. So
people know where to go. They know who to get a hold of on set.
And I think that can go into other and it can go into other parts of the industry. You know, if you make a contract compliant with these safety regulations, and the whole point being, sexual harassment should also be a workplace safety issue.
Agreed.
It should be under the purview of OSHA. And you know, I'm banging my head against the wall because that's not something they want to be dealing with. I mean, they do a great job at what they do. You know, workplace safety and OSHA is very good at what they do. But I personally feel, and so does some of the folks up in Santa Fe here, that this should become part and parcel of your workplace safety package is sexual harassment. If I don't feel safe in my work environment, I don't do a good job. And being harassed by my boss or whoever is an unsafe working condition. So it's changing, it's re-educating how people deal with that. And what that does then is it creates an environment where more women feel safe to be employed in these jobs. Because the Absolutely. Unspoken secret, and Susan, you know this as well as I do, there's jobs we haven't taken, myself included, because we don't want to be harassed. And we know that's going to involve massive putting up with harassment. So we're being kept out of the workplace because we refuse to allow ourselves to be harassed. How do we fix that? We end the holes that allow harassment in the first place. So that's my sort of tiny step forward. But I think women need to use this window that Me Too has created for us to set an example that, because if I've worked on a set with a bunch of women where it's the first time in my life where I haven't been looked at in terms of my cleavage or how short my skirt was, mm-hmm. but how good I did the lighting, I'm probably going to be in tears and changed by that. And I'm going to now know, wow, I don't have to be, you know, leered at to do my job. And I'm a 19-year-old intern or whatever. That changes you. You become a different person from that. And I just feel
it adds value to you too.
Exactly.
I mean, it's that you're valuable in your industry, not because of who you are, but because of what you do. And I think the changes that you're making by doing the Safe Sets Initiative, I think could be astronomical in live sound, in all the sets and on location things that we do everywhere, you know, film, video, audio, lighting, all of those, that can encompass all of that. So that's happening in Santa Fe.
It's going to be statewide. The problem, you know, obviously COVID has put everything on a lockdown. I've never seen the cooperation level that I've seen, and everybody determined to do something. Even some of the male heads of the gentleman who's the head of SAG out here, he's totally behind it. He's absolutely committed. They had great ideas. They were talking about ways they can reach out to LA. They were saying, you know, some of this stuff is already on the books and just not being enforced. So we kind of left the meeting with what's already existing and just not being followed through with versus what needs to be implemented. And so my thing is just the remote location stuff, because I suspect LA and New York and stuff already have some pretty sound policies. They just may be sort of scattershot in how they're enforcing it. But remote location, I don't think is being addressed in the big cities, because most of their productions are urban centers where you could call out, where you could run across the street, you know, there'd be a police officer coming by or something. So I think in that sense, we could lead the industry in terms of if we do it right, we could do it quickly and we could do it well. And so we're taking it pretty seriously in terms of not coming up with something that's unusable or that could get tossed out. Because this Me Too momentum, as we well know, I don't want to lose the Me Too momentum. I want reforms changed before that door closes, basically.
Same here. Is there something you can maybe... As we're talking about, this is the first time I've heard of it, and I think it's amazing. Is there something we all could be doing, or somebody in our government that we need to write to get the ball rolling on our ends or in our states? Or I don't know if someone's already doing that. Like, how do people find out? Like, how did you get into it?
I would love to create a system where nobody can even think about doing it because we've covered all the bases. And that's what I would love to put out there to you folks. Okay. So the same degree of logistical discussions I'm having with my power folks in New Mexico, go find those legislators who speak out about Me Too or speak out about women's rights or speak out about abuse issues. Sit down with them, demand, you know, you pay taxes for their salary.
Right.
You need to get your money's worth. You need to go sit down with your legislators and say, here's the issues I'm concerned about. Here's what's going on in the state. I understand you're working on this initiative. Can we add this aspect to it? Can you listen to me about this? Can I bring a survivor in? Can blah, 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 blah. Legislators, oftentimes, you'll be surprised. They want to help, but no one's contacting them. So they're only acting on what the noisiest, the squeakiest wheel is. So make your topic a squeaky wheel.
I think just knowing that too, just saying, hey, go contact your legislator and bring a survivor with you or somebody, like, let's keep moving.
Thank you, you know?
Much, absolutely.
Laura.
Thank you both.
Thank you so much. This is great.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
You guys have a great day. Happy quarantine.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Hey, we have something exciting to tell you all about. The Sound Girls annual scholarships are now open, and will close July 31st for applications. So get your applications in. You only have to the end of July. There is two $500 scholarships in honor of Ethel Gabriel. Sound Girls will be awarding these two $500 scholarships to members pursuing a career in the recording arts. These scholarships will be awarded in August and can be used for educational training and university programs. The scholarships are open to all members of Sound Girls, including international students. There are also four $250 scholarships open to any member of Sound Girls that is attending or plans to attend an educational program in professional audio. There's no age requirement and includes college programs, trade schools, seminars, and workshops. These applications are open to all gender and non-conforming genders. They will be awarded in August and are open for applications right now until the end of July 31st. So get those apps in. Go to soundgirls.org to find out more about these scholarships. Soundgirls.org. Thank you all for listening to the Sound Girls podcast, Resonating Beyond Sound. We'll catch you next week when we talk to another amazing sound human. Have a great week, all.